Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. And welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with one of my favorite novelists and short story writers, Tim Cottrell, about his new collection, Signals, New and Selected Stories. We'll hear a striking literary song by M. Ward, and I'll have a postcard from my holiday in Paris. The arrival of any new short story by Tim Cottrell is a cause for celebration. And here comes a collection with a bunch of new ones. It's called Signals, New and Selected Stories, and it is your first must-read of 2017. Tim is the author of two previous collections of short stories, Same Place, Same Things, and Welding with Children, and three novels, The Next Step in the Dance, The Clearing, and The Missing. He taught creative writing at Southeastern Louisiana University in Hammond for 30 years and is now retired and lives in Tennessee. Tim Cottrell, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Oh, and it's great to have a new book from you. Now, you've been writing short stories for a long time, and they're distinguished by many things, their wit and humor and their moral compass. And I wonder, do you actually make yourself laugh while you're writing? Do your characters tickle you as much as they tickle us?
Well, yeah, I think the story writing has the same effect on the writer as it does on the reader, or at least it should. And I don't like to be very depressed, so I like to write stories that are not saccharine, but, you know, have a nice blend of tragedy and humor.
Oh, yes. Now, it's so much fun to reread stories over and over again, and it was good to revisit old favorites and have these new ones. And one of the things that struck me in these stories was that sense of pure Cajun canniness, of being good in a crisis, whether it's good at provoking one or good at dealing with them.
Yeah, I'm from a blue-collar family, and I've discovered that people who are undereducated are still smart. They can figure out, you know, what side their bread is buttered on, so to speak, and they know how to get out of jams, and they know how to think on their feet. And really, they're as creative as anybody else.
And they know how to get into jams, too.
Which yeah. Well, I think no matter how smart you are, you can manage that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, I'm struck by the title, of course, and its many meanings. In one story, Radio Magic, the main character becomes obsessed with some old comedy routines and tracks down the originator. And in the title story, Signals, a Latvian immigrant becomes obsessed with a radio receiver, long outdated, that he once repaired, and it leads him to unexpected connections in the real world. So radio is looming a bit in these stories.
Yes, indeed. I guess my fascination with old and obsolete radio equipment comes from the only radio I had as a child. I wanted a radio, so my father gave me a 40-year-old Crosley Fiber, and you could pick up all sorts of things on it late at night. So I'd be up studying late at night, and I'd listen to broadcasts in Spanish, and not from Cuba, but from Spain, and anything that was in the ionosphere would bounce down into that old Crosley. And you could be a world traveler if you had one of those old radios and you were patiently tuning in the weird stations. You could get Chinese, French opera, you could get whatever was up there.
And they sound different. I love the way you describe the richness of sound in those kinds of machines.
Yeah, they do sound different. The older stuff, it whistled and popped, and the signals would fade in and out, and it had a certain mesmerizing effect on the consciousness. And then the stuff that was made in the early 70s, what they called Deep Canyon sound, was so powerful, and the definition of the music was so distinct that it was much better than anything that's produced currently. The way of mechanism to pluck sound from the air.
Now, I was struck by how often the word signals does appear in these stories, you know, missed signals, as well as the literal signals and the intricate circuitry that makes signals possible, and the sense they come from beyond but have up close ramifications. And it's just a wonderful, complicated idea that's preoccupied you for quite a while, I think.
I think so. I mean, there are signals going through our body by the millions right now as we speak, you know, digital radio signals and microwave signals and God knows what all. But there are also signals that we pick up from the pre-electrical world around us that people always used to pick up, you know. Some people call them intuitions. Some people call them little mystical occurrences and sacramentals or whatever. But the human body is an antenna, and it picks up an amazing amount of things. And yeah, I like to think that that's part of how we weave our stories, those of us who write.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of pick up on these signals, these little subtle things that are around us. You know, it's not like we're listening to somebody's cell phone through our it adenoids or whatever, but we get the idea. I think that there's more to life than what's really obvious. It's the subtle stuff that forms us.
And a lot of it's that crackling energy that happens between people, you know, and
yeah.
It can be instantaneous sometimes.
Yeah, and you can sense it, but you can't explain it.
Mm-hmm. But your characters spend a lot of time with electrical circuitry.
I mean, yeah. That's a very electric book.
Right? It is an electric book, I have to say.
Well, that comes to my fascination with mechanism. You give me a 90-pound 1970s era receiver, a Pioneer particularly, that doesn't work, and I can fix it.
Wow.
So it's like working on a steam engine. I mean, it's really a big, clunky circuitry that's easy for an amateur to work on.
Now, I recall at your house in Hammond, you had all these player pianos and steam whistles and all kinds of machines. Did you move all those up to Tennessee?
I just about ruined a Chevrolet truck.
Oh, no.
All of that stuff up the mountain, yeah.
Because you've always been fascinated by the way things work, as well as those old repair guides, I think.
Yeah, well, it's all together. It has to do with the spirit of creativity. I mean, to me, a steam engine is no different than a short story. It's a mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
It's logically structured to do something particular, whether have an effect on the reader or to turn out a lamp base or something, as a metal cutting lathe would do. It's all mechanism.
Well, I'm sorry you almost ruined the truck, but I'm glad you've still got this stuff.
Yeah. I've got a lot of that stuff up there, too much.
Now, a lot of your stories deal with the ordinary folks, folks we see in everyday life, like the Bug Man, for example, and another is the Furnace Man's Lament in this story. A lot of your work deals with repair, with making things right.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sure some graduate student someday in the future will examine the connection between mechanism and the verities of the world and my stories. But that's their job. I can't explain it over the phone. But, yeah, there's a connection. The mechanism is not just an excuse to write about machinery. The mechanism in my stories, there's a connection between theme and all the mechanical stuff that's in my stories. As I said, I came from a family of mechanics, machinists, tugboat captains, you know, tool and die makers, and that's in my DNA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's stuff that fascinates me, and any writing teacher will tell you that you should use your personal fascinations, just as Faulkner did, just as Hemingway did, in your fiction.
Well, I love the way they're always trying to make things right in a very human way, you know? It's just see a problem and reach out for it. Did it make you think of your work differently, surveying the field to put together this collection? Because you've chosen what I guess you think are your very best short stories to put with the new ones. What was that process like for you to go back and revisit your own work?
Well, it's very hard because some of the stories were 25 years old and older, and they weren't even on digital format anymore. So all I had was these hard copies. Well, these copies go through so many revisions over the years. Even when you come up with a final version, an editor changes it to put it in a magazine, and then the next editor changes it to put it in a collection, and the next editor changes it to put it like in a Best American Short Stories or something like that. And then the next egg. So I had dozens of versions of all of these stories, and I didn't know which was which.
Oh, no.
So it took months to straighten that mess out. But as to why I chose the stories I did, I like the ones that exhibit a certain amount of compassion.
Mm-hmm.
Certain amount of self-orientation, somebody trying to make themselves whole.
Yes.
And maybe not succeeding, but at least giving it a shot. that's sort of one of my trademarks, compassion and people trying to make things right in their lives.
Well, Welding with Children will always be one of my favorite short stories, no matter how many incarnations it goes through.
Uh-huh.
It was a happy thing to read that story again. And there's one short story here, as you can imagine, that I particularly liked, called The Review. And in it, a writer has a fantasy of revenge for a bad review on Amazon that turns out very differently. Tim, that story just cracked me up. and broke my heart. I mean, the beginning of it cracked me up, but the end of it broke my heart. That's a typical Tim Gautreaux story. I mean, how many writers have really thought of that? Tracking down the reviewer to see what they're all about.
Yeah, well, you know, occasionally somebody will post a bad review on Amazon and the author will actually respond on Amazon, which I think is pretty silly, although we all are tempted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure everybody reads reviews and everybody has an opinion of the reviews of their work, so it's just a natural thing not to worry about, but to write about. You know, what does a writer, especially a writer who's very vulnerable, who's you know, not an A-list writer, who has managed to have one book published, and you know, there are like six reviews of it, and one guy trashes it, and then we have a melding of these two worlds. You know, I mean, it's a natural tension device to use in that particular story. Not only is the writer who's gotten this terrible customer review angry, he decides to get in his car and drive to wherever
yes.
the guy lives, you know, and talk to him about it and spy on him.
Well, that's another thing I love about your characters. They get in the car and drive. You know, they just don't mess around. But I thought, oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. But as you know, nothing but love from this reviewer. So I should say that. So do you miss Louisiana? I know you're happy with those grandkids. But has living in Tennessee made you think about Louisiana differently, made you see it in a new light?
Well, it was just time to move near the grandchildren. I enjoy the climate up here better, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I live on top of Signal Mountain, and it's cooler and it's drier, and there are no mosquitoes. And all the older relatives in the family have passed away, and the only reason I was staying in Louisiana to begin with is kind of take care of my sister, who passed away at age 80. And so, you know, it's just time to go somewhere else. And my wife is from North Carolina, so we're closer to her relatives now.
Uh-huh.
But as far as what I miss about Louisiana, naturally, is the food.
of course.
And the music. And, you know, we were only 55 minutes from New Orleans when we lived in Hammond. So there was all that stuff to do down there in New Orleans, and that's to be missed. But somebody asked me the other day, what do you do for seafood up here? You know, it was a friend from Louisiana. And I said, well, we buy magazines and we look at pictures of it.
I hope you and Winborn are still dancing. I always think of you as a dancing couple.
Yeah, well, we went to her 50th high school reunion the other day, and so we did some jitterbugging. Yeah.
All right. Well, it made me very happy to see that you're still writing about Louisiana with such grace and humor in this book. It was really a treat, Tim.
Oh, good.
We've been talking with Tim Gautreaux, whose new book is Signals, New and Selected Stories. And you can meet him Monday, January 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books, or Tuesday, January 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Tim, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Susan. Thank you.
One of my resolutions this year was to read more books in translation. So when I was searching for songs inspired by books, this tune caught my ear. It's M. Ward's Chinese translation from the 2006 album Post-War. One website suggests it's reminiscent of Leo Tolstoy's Three Questions, but the online comments draw comparisons to Buddhist texts, Wittgenstein, many others. The song's about a young man on a quest. He seeks out a wise man sitting under a weeping willow tree to ask his three pressing questions. As happens with so many wisdom quests, the old man turns the questions back on the pilgrim, for he was once one himself. But the questions are still worth asking, and isn't that what the great questions do? They endure from language to language, story and song. Here's M. Ward's Chinese translation. Enjoy.
I sailed a wide, wide sea, climbed up a tall, tall mountain. I met an old, old man beneath the weeping willow tree. He said, now if you got some questions, go and lay them at my feet. But my time here is brief, so you'll have to pick just three. And I said, what do you do with the pieces of a broken heart? And how can a man like me remain in the light? And if life is really as short as they say, then why is the night so long? And then the sun went down and he sang for me this song. See, I once was a young fool like you, afraid to do the things that I knew I had to do. So I played an escapade just like you. I played an escapade just like you. I sailed a wild, wild sea, climbed up a tall, tall mountain. I met an old, old man. He sat beneath the sapling tree. He said, now if you got some questions, go and lay them at my feet. But my time here is brief, so you'll have to pick just three. And I said, what do you do with the pieces of broken heart?
Here's a postcard from my holiday in Paris, where my daughter and I spent a dreamy holiday with my son, who's teaching there this year. Every trip to a city means a literary pilgrimage to me, whether it's to a bookstore, a gravesite, a writer's historic house. And it means reading ahead of time, too. So for a holiday trip to Paris, I started with Elaine Sciolino's The Only Street in Paris, about her life on the Rue des Martyrs, and how much of the world there was to see on one single street. That later proved true on our street, too. So much life in a nearby restaurant, a tiny market across the street where we could see the man setting up his fruit displays, taking them in every night, the children in the Luxembourg Gardens, the people at the bus stop, lovers on their way back from the bakery around the corner kissing in the middle of the street, and yes, even drunks singing outside on New Year's Eve. I followed that up with John Baxter's Saint-Germain-des-Prés, Paris's Rebel Quarter, the first in his great Parisian neighborhood series. It was useful and entertaining. He lives in a building on the Rue de l'Odéon, where Sylvia Beach, the publisher of James Joyce's Ulysses, had her famed bookshop Shakespeare and Company. So he knows his neighborhood. I can't wait for the others in the series. But I almost finished it as we were waiting for our flight, so I had an anxiety attack about not having enough to read on the plane. Thank goodness for airport bookstores. And sometimes the book you pick up in the airport is just the book you need. So it was with The Paper Menagerie and Other Stories by Ken Liu. I was drawn by stories with names like The Bookmaking Habits of Select Species and An Advanced Reader's Picture Book of Comparative Cognitions, and they turned out to be pure delight. Here's the beginning of the first story. There is no definitive census of all the intelligent species in the universe. Not only are there perennial arguments about what qualifies as intelligence, but each moment and everywhere, civilizations rise and fall much as stars are born and die. Time devours all. Yet every species has its unique way of passing on its wisdom through the ages, its way of making thoughts visible, tangible, frozen for a moment like a bulwark against the irresistible tide of time. Everyone makes books. I was hooked. I'd found my perfect vacation book. We had rented an apartment on the Rue de Sas, partly because it was advertised as book and art filled. Because I'm not always the best trip planner, and I'm an incalculable romantic, I read right past the fourth floor no elevator notice and didn't really stop to consider how I would feel in a cozy apartment surrounded by books in a language I could not read. But still, their presence was a comfort, and I struggled through some picture books with my scraps of French. Walking around Paris, it's amazing to see how writers are venerated. A trip to the Pantheon and you linger at memorials to Antoine Saint-Exupéry, as well as Émile Zola, Victor Hugo, Voltaire, and Rousseau. A temple of the gods indeed. Streets are named for writers all over the place. You can drink at a café where Simone de Beauvoir did her work, pass an ordinary doorway on the Rue de Fleurus, and see a sign marking the residence of Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. I know there are tourists who would be embarrassed to be reading Hemingway's A Movable Feast in Paris, but I am not one of them. Like New Orleans, Paris is a city that shimmers with the patina of all the lives lived on its storied streets. Finally, we come to that great mecca for American literary pilgrims, Shakespeare and Company, on the Rue de Boucherie. The crowd inside was like a mini UN, so many nationalities, so many languages, so many people carrying books in their arms. In keeping with my resolution to read new authors, I picked up a Scandinavian thriller for the trip home, The Ice Beneath Her Feet by Camilla Grebe. Newly published in the United States, and I highly recommend it for sheer creepiness. And then I impulsively grabbed The Wandering Pine by Per Olof Enquist, the Swedish novelist and playwright. Reading it made me feel like I had a guided tour of contemporary Swedish literature and politics. And four books by poets new to me, Emily Barry, Sophie Collins, Sarah Hesketh. Poetry books are small and beautiful, and you can fit so many of them into a jam-packed suitcase. After you climb Shakespeare and Company's stairs, with a quote from Rumi painted on the risers, I wish I could show you, when you are lonely or in darkness, the astonishing light of your own being. Then you come to the Sylvia Beach Memorial Library, where the books are not for sale, simply for reading. I joined a small group of people who pulled books from the shelves and took a seat to read for a while. In the window overlooking Notre Dame was a writing table with a manual typewriter, a reminder of a writer's invisible presence. It was a quiet moment in a busy city. In the introduction to The Paper Menagerie, Ken Liu describes the improbability of the whole writing enterprise, words in one brain making the long journey to connect with a reader. He writes, "The entire system seems fragile, preposterous, science fictional. Who can say if the thoughts you have in your mind as you read these words are the same thoughts I had in my mind as I typed them? We are different, you and I, and the qualia of our consciousnesses are as divergent as two stars at the end of the universe. And yet, whatever has been lost in translation in the long journey of my thoughts through the maze of civilization to your mind, I think you do understand me, and you think you do understand me. Our minds manage to touch, if briefly and imperfectly. Does the thought not make the universe seem just a bit kinder, a bit brighter, a bit warmer, and more human? We live for such miracles," he writes. So there, in the Sylvia Beach Memorial Library, was a circle of readers, half a world away from the ones I knew back home, but strangers sharing a moment. The world of books makes these sorts of unlikely connections every minute, all around the world. Lovely to be reminded of that. So keep reading, keep those miracles coming, and until next time, au revoir. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Lydia Peel reads from and signs her debut novel, The Midnight Cool, with live music by her husband, Ketch Secor of the Old Crow Medicine Show, Tuesday, January 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Peggy Scott Laborde discusses The Fairgrounds Through the Lens at Author Night at the Hubble Library, Tuesday, January 17th at 6:30 at the Hubble Library. The Romance Book Group discusses Blood Vow by J.R. Ward, Tuesday, January 17th at 7 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Michael Tisserand discusses and signs Crazy, George Harriman, A Life in Black and White, Wednesday, January 18th at 6 at the Rosa Keller Library. Historian Justin Nystrom presents a lecture based on his forthcoming book, Creole Italian, How Sicilian Immigrants Shaped the Culture of America's Most Interesting Food Town, Wednesday, January 18th at 6:30 at Gallier House, 1126 Royal Street. Free to members, tickets available at eventbrite.com for non-members. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose, Saturday, January 21st at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Tim Gautreaux, reads from and signs Signals, New and Selected Stories, Monday, January 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books, and Tuesday, January 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Living Library Program, The Power of Your Story, sponsored by Tulane University's Howard Tilton Library, was originally scheduled for January 26th through 28th. It's been rescheduled for March 17th through 19th. Here's how it works. Individuals volunteer to be books, and attendees become readers who check out a book, meaning they sit with the volunteer to hear their story. If you'd like to volunteer to tell your story, check out LibGuides, that's LibGuides, tulane.edu/livinglibrary. If you're a student who's a fan of Jane Austen, consider entering the 2017 Jane Austen Society of North America's Essay Contest, which invites you to submit short essays that address imagining film or stage adaptations of Austen's work. Prizes are generous, and the deadline is May 21st, 2017. For more information, visit the Essay Contest page at jasna.org. And here's some good news. One Book, One New Orleans, after 13 years as a project of the Young Leadership Council, is moving to become an independent 501c3 organization, led by longtime project leader Dr. Megan Holt. This year, the books nominated for the 2017 reading selection make for an interesting reading list. Here's what they are so far. New Orleans Noir, edited by Julie Smith, Queen Sugar by Natalie Bazile, Counting Descent by Clint Smith, The Story of Dan Bright, Crime, Corruption, and Injustice in the Crescent City by Dan Bright and Justin Noble, The Infinite by Nick Maneri, The Accidental City, Improvising New Orleans by Lawrence Powell, and Bienville's Dilemma, An Historical Geography of New Orleans by Richard Campanella. You'll have to wait to find out what the selection is, but you might want to start reading in advance. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.